Good morning, this is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. The federal government's National Task Force on the drug ICE, or crystal methamphetamine, is in Darwin today to hear about the impact ICE is having in the Northern Territory and how people are dealing with it. Community groups will tell the task force the territory needs better support for families and better services to stop the drug gaining a foothold in remote Indigenous communities. But the Northern Territory already has high rates of alcohol abuse, and community groups are warning governments against removing any money from tackling the territory's grog problems. Sarah Everingham reports from Darwin.
Every day, Donna Hunter's grandchildren return from school to her house in Darwin's northern suburbs.
No.
Okay, boys, we're heading on ahead off to the library.
Yeah.
All right, Dal. Is it locked?
Yeah.
Okay.
Donna Hunter has been caring for her three grandchildren since her daughter was sent to prison 18 months ago for an offence committed after taking the drug ICE.
It just doesn't equate a week being on a binge with ICE and doing crimes from the effects of the ICE to missing out on 3.5 years of her children.
And how are you finding it?
At the time, it was pretty devastating. Just got to cope. I've just got to do the job and continue on doing it until Mum comes home.
A year ago, Donna Hunter set up a community group for families in situations like hers. It's called Crying Out for Help. Today, she's been invited to be part of the Darwin consultation of the National ICE Task Force.
We support one another, even though some of us have got children incarcerated from crimes related to the use of meth. We still continue on because we know how important this is for other families and friends.
Donna Hunter wants to tell the task force the Northern Territory needs long-term rehabilitation specifically for ICE users. She's calling for better education and prevention services to stop the spread of ICE in urban areas and to stop it taking hold in the Northern Territory's remote Indigenous communities.
A lot of community members are saying if it came through here, the lack of resources that they have out there, what could happen there? So they want a prevention instead of an intervention.
She's also calling for the reinstatement of a drug court in the Northern Territory that could divert people into rehabilitation for drug or alcohol addictions. The previous one was dismantled by the Northern Territory Country Liberal government after winning office in 2012.
What we see now is people are being incarcerated. My understanding is it's not registered that there is an ICE problem.
It's not just the federal government that's looking at ways to tackle ICE. The Northern Territory government has set up its own inquiry. Wendy Morton from the Northern Territory Council of Social Service welcomes the attention.
Treatment services have reported a rise in the number of people accessing treatment for ICE addiction. It doesn't mean that there's necessarily more people seeking treatment, but more people are seeking treatment for ICE.
Wendy Morton says ICE addicts often need extra support, and she's worried the Northern Territory government has not allocated any extra money to tackling the drug. She's warning the Territory government not to remove any funds from programs that tackle the Territory's high rate of alcohol abuse.
Alcohol is still the number one issue in our community. We can't allow government to take resources away from the alcohol treatment sector in order to deal with the ICE sector. It needs to be additional resources.
Donna Hunter wants to make sure there is help for her daughter and others like her when they're able to return home.
I'm terrified what could happen when my daughter gets released. My aim is to ensure that we have appropriate services available so that it's not returning back to prison, that help is there.
That's the founder of the Crying Out for Help group, Donna Hunter, ending Sarah Everingham's report. The Northern Territory government says it will allocate more resources to tackling ICE if its inquiry recommends it. The Prime Minister says getting kids to school is one of the government's priorities in Indigenous affairs. Today, he'll launch a blueprint for success for some of the country's leading boarding schools to help boost the number of Indigenous students finishing Year 12. It's been written by the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation, which offers more than 500 scholarships a year. Lindy Kerrin reports.
Letitia Dunbar moved away from her Darwin home when she was 15. She won a scholarship at St Peter's Lutheran College in Brisbane and started boarding in Year 9.
The challenges would have to be being out of your comfort zone, being away from your friends and family, and when you do fly back and forth each term, you're still kind of thinking like, oh, should I stay with my family and friends or should I go back and, you know, get a good education and graduate?
She says ongoing support from her family, teachers and fellow students helped her become the first person in her family to finish Year 12.
Studying is number one priority, and so, like, I've never had that before when I was up in Darwin, and so once we'd finish dinner, it would be straight to studying, and the mistress who looked after us, they would come over to us and just help us.
Now 20 years old and studying at university, Letitia Dunbar says other members of her family have followed her lead.
Once my family started to see that how much it was benefiting me and how much confidence I was gaining, they got my brother onto the scholarship, and then he went to St. Joseph Nudgee College, and now he's graduated. And I've also got my cousins down in boarding schools in Melbourne and Adelaide. So it's just such an amazing feeling that for them to be able to see their cousin going to a boarding school and graduate gave them the confidence to be able to fly down all the way from Tiwi Islands down to Adelaide and sticking through it. And it just makes me so proud and happy.
It's stories like these that make up the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation's Guide to Best Practice for the country's leading boarding schools. The author, Renee Coffey, says it's based on interviews with more than 50 schools about what's working.
They included strong leadership from the principal for the program, having good relationships with the students, with families and communities, a range of things like that, which are quite simple but really important so that schools can have a successful Indigenous education program.
The Foundation's Executive Director, Andrew Penfold, says the 100-page report being released by the Prime Minister shares the expertise and knowledge of schools that have been working in the field for the past 10 to 20 years.
You know, in the early days of these programs, everyone, every school and in any school, whether they're boarding schools or not, any school will make mistakes and learn lessons from things that they trial and errors and so on. And so the issue is, how do we help new schools coming to it to understand what best practice looks like and understand the most successful strategies that are being used elsewhere so that they can replicate it and achieve better outcomes in a much shorter period of time?
Andrew Penfold from the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation speaking to Lindy Kerin. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 17 minutes past 7. Buried deep in the budget papers last week was a decision to abolish funding for the country's only not-for-profit community-funded pharmacy based in Melbourne. Serving pensioners, refugees, migrants and some of the poorest people in the city's inner north, the pharmacy is part of a streamlined one-stop community health centre set up 20 years ago. On Monday, the government signed the sixth community pharmacy agreement worth $19 billion, but this community pharmacy will lose its funding of around $500,000 in December. Those who work in the centre say it saves the government money each year, and if anything, the integrated model should be rolled out nationally. Alison Caldwell compiled this report.
Morning, Jasmine. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Kate.
Now, how can I help?
The not-for-profit community health centre in Collingwood, in Melbourne's inner north, provides an integrated one-stop health service for some of the city's poorest people. It includes a pharmacy which delivers prescriptions at cost price.
Can you show me exactly where it's sore?
Jasmine and her four children have been visiting the centre for 12 years. Today she has an appointment with one of CoHealth's doctors, Dr. Kate Coles.
I've got an anxiety issue, so coming to one place and dealing with everything all in one go is heaps easier for me to do rather than go to different doctors and different nurses and different pharmacists.
We're seeing the people that other services just think it's too hard.
Dr. Coles has been working with the centre since 2009. She says having the pharmacy under the same roof makes a huge difference for patients and their doctors.
Yeah, because we got people who, yes, at low socioeconomic backgrounds, they're getting the medicines the cheapest and safest way possible.
Ruth Cironi is one of the two pharmacists who work here. She says the patients will be far worse off without the service.
There are going to be a lot of patients here who will be very disadvantaged. They won't cope without the immediacy of this pharmacy. They often probably won't even bother to get their medication. A lot of the patients here have mobility issues. If they've got to go to another pharmacy, it's going to take more time and they just won't do it.
We were shocked, and I think more than shocked, I think we're quite dismayed.
Lynn Morgan is the chief executive of CoHealth. She says the centre's integrated GP pharmacy model saves the federal government $346,000 each year.
We report to them regularly, are required to report on the savings made to the PBS as a consequence of the program. So annually that's estimated by the department's own figures at about $350,000, and they only fund us $200,000 for the administration component anyway.
Lynn Morgan says the centre wasn't consulted in the lead-up to the budget.
I would prefer to conclude that this is an error than, I guess, the other possibilities, which is that there is a deliberate attempt to remove from the landscape a cost-effective, high-quality model because it's not consistent with private interests. If that were so, then I would be deeply troubled.
CoHealth's Chief Executive Lynn Morgan, ending that report by Alison Caldwell. While the Prime Minister and Treasurer have been crisscrossing the country selling the budget, backbenchers have been testing the mood in their electorates. Liberal MP Craig Laundie is embracing what he calls an easier sell than last year, but he's warned the government must also turn its attention to tax reform. Susan McDonald reports from his Western Sydney electorate.
For Craig Laundie, the pub is his second home. He turned his back on the family hotel business to join politics as the member for Reid.
I've grown up in the public bars of Western Sydney. There is no better place to put anything to the test.
The first term MP did that this time last year with the Abbott government's first budget.
And a lot of those measures weren't liked, and it was tough to keep standing in the front lines and prosecuting the case for change.
With more support for childcare and small businesses, this year it's different.
These are things that are particularly relevant to the people of Reid, and getting on the front foot and talking to them about changes we can make is a lot easier sell.
At one of his regular pub hangouts last night, Mr Laundie was surrounded by a friendly crowd.
I must admit, as a small businessman myself, mate, I'm totally optimistic about the opportunities that it gives us.
I think it was a huge relief. Given the shortcomings in revenue over the last 12 months, that it wasn't as hard as what some people thought it was.
But elsewhere in his electorate, he says there's concern about changes to stop so-called double dipping of paid parental leave.
But when I sit and talk with people, be it at train stations, in the street, in the office or in pubs like this, it's a six-year package is what I'm explaining. The first 6 months is the PPL component. The other 5.5 years is the childcare component and about driving female participation in the workforce and the productivity gains.
This year's budget was a key test for Tony Abbott's leadership. Government backbenchers appear to already be setting him another one.
The key for us as a government, in my humble backbench opinion, comes later in the year, and that revolves around the taxation white paper and the federation white paper. The real struggle for us, the real battle for us, will be to put our mind to reform based around those two documents that we take to the next election.
Liberal MP Craig Laundie ending that report from Susan McDonald. A court in Northern Ireland has ruled against a bakery which refused to make a cake ordered by a gay customer with a pro-marriage slogan on it. The Christian owners of the bakery say they're extremely disappointed with the ruling, and Northern Ireland's biggest political party is vowing to push ahead with legislation to allow service providers to discriminate on the basis of their religious convictions. Europe correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
The occasion for which the cake was intended has long passed, but the battle over whether it should have been baked continues. A court in Belfast has found that the Christian-run Asher's Baking Company was guilty of discrimination when it refused to carry out an order placed by a gay man for a cake with a pro-gay marriage slogan on it. The court heard that the decision made the customer, Gareth Lee, feel unworthy and a lesser person. Northern Ireland's Equality Commission helped bring the case to court. Chief Commissioner Michael Wardlow.
The cake and the money isn't important. It's whether or not someone like Gareth can walk into a shop or a hotel or a restaurant and wonder, can I be served here because they may have a different religious opinion than me? This is not about the cake.
Daniel MacArthur is the Christian-run bakery's manager.
We just want to live and work in accordance with our religious beliefs. It determines how we live, how we bring up our children and how we run our business. We can't just leave it out when we go to work in the morning. And we know we've done the right decision before God, and we have no regrets about what we've done.
The cake case has divided Northern Ireland, with large public rallies being held in support of both sides. Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK that has not passed a law to introduce same-sex marriage. A referendum on the introduction of same-sex marriage will be held later this week in the Republic of Ireland. Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party wants to push ahead with trying to introduce a conscience clause law which would allow organisations or individuals to refuse service if it conflicted with their religious beliefs. Paul Given, a DUP member of the Northern Ireland Assembly, is behind that initiative.
What we cannot have is a hierarchy of rights, and today there is a clear hierarchy being established that gay rights are more important than the rights of people to hold religious beliefs. And we need to now move in the Assembly to strike the right balance.
Gavin Boyd of the Rainbow Project says he hopes the DUP will withdraw their plans for a conscience clause.
That has been something which has been hugely damaging, hugely concerning for members of our community across Northern Ireland, that somehow that members of the Assembly will introduce a bill that will allow businesses to deny them access to goods, facilities or services.
The Christian Bakery has been ordered to pay $1,000 in compensation to the customer whose cake was eventually made by another bakery. The ruling may still be appealed in a case about so much more than a cake. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
The Australian Tax Office is about to crack down on new players in the digital economy that don't meet their tax obligations. It's a broad digital brush, but the tax man is targeting the ride-sharing service Uber, which has become an increasingly popular competitor to normal taxis. The ATO says Uber is no different to traditional bricks-and-mortar businesses and has to pay tax and collect the 10% GST from its customers. The ATO's Deputy Commissioner James O'Halloran spoke with our business editor Peter Ryan.
Today we've released the ATO view on the GST and income tax obligations that arise from such emerging technologies that are available from apps and websites. And I think the main point is that the current laws for GST and income tax equally apply regardless of the use of the technology.
Is there a perception that if you're a new digital player like Uber or Airbnb that somehow tax laws don't apply?
Look, I think the message from the ATO today is that, in fact, regardless of the technology, the current laws for both GST and income tax apply and people need to be aware of their obligations.
But there will be different treatment for Uber and Airbnb. Uber has to collect GST regardless of income, but an Airbnb operator only has to charge GST if income exceeds $75,000 a year. So why the different treatment?
Whilst I can't comment on individual companies or businesses, the taxi industry since the commencement of GST has always had a different rule under the GST Act, whereby the threshold was not a determinant of whether people needed to register for GST. So really, the taxi service industry, it's a level playing field issue that's equally applicable and has been since GST. And in relation to Airbnb and those types of operations, residential rent is not subject to GST, but as usual, people need to declare the income that they derive from such activities.
It is a complex picture, but Uber says the average driver only works around 20 hours a week and might only make $30,000 a year. So is Uber right to feel unfairly treated or confused in this ruling?
Well, as the tax office, we can only apply the law as it currently stands, and the level of income is not relevant for those providing taxi services, and has always been the case.
Both Uber and Airbnb are increasingly popular, but they have been around for a few years, so it has taken some time for the ATO to deliver this warning.
Well, some people might have that view, but we've been consulting with industry and various players in the industry for some months to make sure we understood the current situation, and that's why we've issued the two pieces of information today so that the general community can be aware of their obligations and make decisions now and into the future.
The digital boom has been disrupting traditional taxis and, of course, hotels, so the money has been going in a different direction. Does the ATO have any dollar figure on how much tax it might be missing?
Look, we don't. Our point from today was to alert those involved in these sort of activities to be aware. And with respect to the taxi services people involved, we've in fact given them till the 1st of August to register, recognising that there'll be some adjustments required.
So just to be clear, if you are an Airbnb operator, you might not necessarily be subject to collecting GST unless you make more than $75,000 a year.
Well, in fact, if it's residential rent, you're not subject to GST at all, as opposed to commercial rent, but certainly you do need to declare the income in your income tax returns.
There might be people listening to this who are in carpooling schemes or share the costs of using a vehicle. Should they be worried that the tax man or the tax woman is sharpening his or her pen?
No, look, the short answer is no. We don't consider carpooling and those types of situations as being caught under any of the current tax laws, but we do advise people to check our information that we've published today.
After last week's budget, there could be benefits, though, for these type of business operators being officially registered, given the new concessions or tax breaks for small business.
Well, certainly any business, as announced in the budget, is able to avail themselves of the new announcement, subject to the normal rules of deductions.
Deputy Tax Commissioner James O'Halloran with our business editor Peter Ryan. And more in finance, Wall Street has ended flat despite earlier data showing the US economy is continuing to grow. New home construction surged in April to the highest level since November 2007, before the US housing slump. Oil is lower at $57.25 a barrel. The Australian dollar is weaker this morning. It's buying 79.15 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.